This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Here's the thing. This resentment has always existed because people don't want to admit what this country is founded upon, which is the raping, pillaging, and stealing of Native American lands. I mean, I grew up on a reservation and learned in elementary school that Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492 and discovered America. And when I raised my hand, I think I was in third grade, "Hey teacher, that's great, where were we?" Because we were here already. And the answer I got was, "We're not covering that. That's not in the book."
Was all the work to try to keep the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines from being built done in vain now that Donald Trump occupies the White House? Not if you ask this week's guest on Sea Change Radio, Candy Mossett, a leading organizer for the Indigenous Environmental Network. Mossett takes us behind the scenes of Native Americans' fight to preserve their sacred lands. We discuss the connection between protecting the environment and advocating for Native American rights, talk about how struggles from Standing Rock to Bear's Ears have stimulated activism and raised awareness, and recognize the value that this movement has, even in the face of setbacks, like the ascension of an obscenely pro-corporate presidential administration. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Candy Mossett. She is the lead organizer for the Extreme Energy and Just Transition campaign for the Indigenous Environmental Network. Candy, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So the Extreme Energy and Just Transition campaign, explain for our listeners what that is.
Well, today, as people may or may not know, we have gone to great lengths to get our energy resources, predominantly through the fossil fuel industry. And when we say extreme energy, we're talking about things like tar sands extraction, which is happening up in Canada, where one of the symptoms of that is the Keystone XL pipeline, for example, which we defeated, or so we thought, until number 45 came back into office and has now put Keystone XL back on the table. And so tar sands extraction is a very extreme form of energy because it takes about 3 to 6 barrels of water for every 1 barrel of oil. So the energy input versus the energy that you get out doesn't make any sense. It's also true when it comes to hydraulic fracturing, which is happening across the United States. Personally, I'm from North Dakota, and so we see the extreme energy happening there, digging down 10,000 feet and essentially creating mini earthquakes so that they can remove the shale oil that's trapped between the shale rocks. So when we say extreme energy, we're talking about non-conventional sources, and trying to move away from that is definitely a process. It doesn't just happen overnight, which is why we talk about just transition. And I guess if you put the word just in front of anything, it makes it a little better. And so we had a transition campaign. But with that campaign, we saw things that were happening where people were losing their jobs. For example, working with Black Mesa Water Coalition in the Southwest, they were able to shut down Peabody Coal in their area, but about 200 workers lost their jobs, and so it was not a good thing for people in the community. So just transition is a phasing out of jobs in the fossil fuel industry while simultaneously bringing in jobs in a renewable energy sector or areas that don't harm the people that work in those positions.
And why don't we take a step back, and if you can explain your background in North Dakota and your Native American heritage, as well as the mission and history of the Indigenous Environmental Network, that would be great.
Sure. So I am from North Dakota, born and raised. I grew up in a little tiny town called Newtown, North Dakota, which is on what is known today by the federal government as the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, otherwise home of the Mandan, Hidatsa, Arikara nations. And so three separate tribes put together on one reservation. And I am Mandan, Hidatsa on my dad's side, as well as German. And I am Arikara and Chippewa and Norwegian on my mom's side. but always grew up in North Dakota and didn't really realize how heavily of a fossil fuel state it was until I began really working with the Indigenous Environmental Network, which my time started around 2007. And the organization itself, though, has been around since about 1990. And basically, we were born out of the American Indian movement when it became very militant and started to sort of fall apart. We knew that there was a necessity to have an education place, a clearinghouse of information that people could use and could come to be able to continue to organize in our communities. And so, yeah, it's been 27 years now. It's been a very long time. And we've been pretty successful at building a network and building a foundation of community members that we work with. It started, I would say, in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, and it has since really spread worldwide on an international level, because we do work within the United Nations Framework on Convention on Climate Change and try to look at the international models and tools that we can use to help with our communities on a grassroots level. Things like the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, for example. How can we use that as a tool to help organize in our communities that are trying to create change?
Yes, when anybody who's been to the Goldman Environmental Prize, this is a very prestigious prize for activism and environmental good works. It seems like there is always an Indigenous activist element, but it's usually not within the United States. It's encouraging to see that your organization has reached out to these little pockets of important activism within Indigenous communities all over the world.
Well, I think it's a necessity to be able to connect each other, to see that we're not alone in the struggle that we face. And it's been very helpful, I think, all the way around for us and for other organizations to come together at that international level. And so it's really a tool. It's one of the tools of the many. But what we've learned over the years and what we've always been about is using our sort of natural law and our cultural background as Indigenous nations here in the United States, and see that that is at an international level too. People all around the world in Indigenous communities have that sort of tie, that connection to the land, and we see how similar we are in our struggles.
So let's dive into some of the struggles that you and your colleagues have been engaged in the last several years. You mentioned the Keystone XL pipeline, but mm-hmm. Standing Rock and the Dakota Access Pipeline have been first and foremost on your to-do list. Why don't you kind of recap where we are right now with this struggle?
Yeah, I think that Standing Rock definitely brought a lot of attention to the work that was already happening. It definitely brought worldwide attention. I think that was thanks to social media, really. With Standing Rock, we had been fighting fracking in the Bakken since around 2007 already, prior to this.
Why don't you explain what the Bakken is first?
Yeah, a lot of people don't understand that the Dakota Access Pipeline is just one thing. It's a pipeline. There's got to be a place where that oil is coming from, and that is the Bakken Shale oil fields in predominantly North Dakota. It also cuts up into Canada and into Montana as well, but it covers the entire area of the Williston Basin. And through hydraulic fracturing, there has been oil coming out of the Bakken since around 2006. Hydraulic fracturing took off after the 2005 Energy Policy Act, which had a change that occurred in it called the Halliburton Loophole. And the reason why it's called that is because, well, at the time, Vice President Dick Cheney was the recent CEO of Halliburton, and it was Dick Cheney who was instrumental in getting that change, where the oil and gas industry was basically exempted from the Clean Drinking Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act. And so this became known as the Halliburton loophole. And that's when fracking was really able to take off across the country, was after that 2005 Energy Policy Act change. So I believe there's fracking in 32 states or 34 states. It could be more by now. I focus on North Dakota because it came to my community and impacted us very, very deeply and very negatively. And the environmental impacts we are facing are definitely a challenge, but the social impacts, I think, were things that nobody was ever prepared for. And so we have been fighting things like sex trafficking, kidnapping, rape, assault, abuse. Ever since the man camps moved into North Dakota, the violence against women increased by 168%, which you can't really wrap your mind around what that statistic means unless you live in the community and see the change. It's night and day. You know, I used to walk to school when I was a kid. You can't do that anymore. And this is a small town. These are small communities that are no longer safe. And this is the Bakken. This is where this oil is coming from for the Dakota Access Pipeline.
There was a young brave who, before he was 10, played war games in the woods with his Indian friends. And he knew that dream that when he grew up, he would be a fearless warrior, an Indian chief. Oh, many moons passed, and his dream grew strong. Till tomorrow he would sing his first war song. Battle, but something went wrong. A surprise attack killed him in his sleep at night. And so castles name sand slips into the sea.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Candy Mossett. She's an organizer for the Indigenous Environmental Network. So, Candy, what's been the role of Energy Transfer Partners, the company behind the pipeline, through all of the Standing Rock protests?
The Mandan, Hidatsa, Rikara Nations were actually bullied by the Energy Transfer Partner Company. They were given basically an ultimatum saying, you sign the paperwork for this pipe to go through your land and we'll give you X amount of dollars, or we're going to condemn the land and we're going to build the pipeline anyways. And the reason they could do this was because the area that they wanted to go through was on fee land, on our buffalo ranch. And because the tribe didn't get that land put into trust and it was still fee land, the company could do condemnation and put it through. But unfortunately, my tribes, the Mandan, Hidatsa, Rikara Nations, didn't fight back the way the Standing Rock Sioux tribe did. In fact, they signed the agreement in December of 2015 to allow Dakota Access Pipeline to cross across the buffalo ranch. This is further north. And so when that struggle began, I really was watching Standing Rock because they had already put a moratorium on fracking on their reservation in 2009, which was great. And then in 2014, they flat out told the company, no, you cannot cross our land. No, we do not want a pipeline. And so when you fast forward to 2016, that's when all of the attention finally came about this whole issue and this whole struggle, in light of the arrests that started happening in August when the company tried to start building. And it was really women and girls that went out and started initially getting arrested in August. Even though former President Barack Obama signed papers saying that the easement wouldn't be granted, he did that in December, we celebrated for a day. I remember it was December 4th. But we knew who was the incoming president. And literally, just a few days into his presidency, Donald Trump did sign the piece of paper saying that he was going to allow the Dakota Access Pipeline to move forward. And he totally negated the entire environmental impact statement review process, which is something that's never been done before. There were literally hundreds of thousands of comments that had already been put in, and it was all brushed aside.
As were the multiple treaties that were signed since 1851. Maybe you can also kind of recap those for our listeners.
Well, the area where the pipeline goes through is disputed area anyways. The Standing Rock Sioux tribe has an area of land that was never ceded to the federal government. There were two treaties. There was the 1851 treaty and the 1868 treaty. And in both of those treaties, they never ceded the land to the federal government. It was basically stolen and it was taken. So this government is in violation of its own constitution by not upholding the treaty rights that it made with the tribal nations. So Standing Rock really called out the larger picture of the problem in the United States, is that there are nearly 400 treaties that were made in this country. Not one was kept.
When the president calls Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas mockingly, how does that make you and your colleagues at the Indigenous Environmental Network feel?
Well, I can't speak for other people, but sure, I can tell you that it made me feel, at first I would say I was angry, but then it just made me feel sort of sad for an individual that is so uneducated, and then sad for our country that this individual is now our president. I'm just surprised he hasn't been impeached yet. I'm surprised he became president. I think it just shows the corruption in politics and the ties with the industry, which we always knew existed. I mean, we knew that through the Bush administrations, both Bush administrations, but it's never been more clear, the ties through the fossil fuel industry and the government, than it is with Donald Trump, who is basically a puppet of the Koch brothers and the industry. I mean, look at all of his picks. You know, you have the EPA being taken over by the industry. Just the whole entire thing is one big coup d'etat, and I can't believe he's still in his position as president.
And there was some hope from one of his appointments, the Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. I have a friend who works at the U.S. Geological Survey, and his fingers were crossed. He said it may not be as bad as Scott Pruitt, but Zinke has kind of shown his stripes recently during a visit to Bears Ears. Maybe you can tell our listeners what Bears Ears is all about.
Bears Ears is a national monument, which it's a sacred place. It's a sacred site for the local people. As Native people, we often have our stories and our histories and our oral traditions in the land. There's a lot of stories that go with where we live. And it's kind of disgusting that this administration is attacking all national monuments as a direct result of going after Bears Ears. It's like Donald Trump just, and we know this, we know he has a contention with Native American people. And we know about it because when casinos were an issue in the 90s, he fought back. He didn't want casinos to happen because it was going to be impacting his money. Anyways, in Utah, there's this national monument that is a sacred site, and it is under attack now by the Trump administration. And as a result, they're attacking, I think, 27 national monuments that they're going to try to take off as designated national monuments so that industry can happen there. It's a really telling sign that Donald Trump is unstable and he picks and chooses battles in an unequal way, specifically with us as Native people in this country. He's racist.
Well, come gather around me, people. A story I'd like to tell about a brave young Indian that you should remember well. From a tribe of Pima Indians, a proud and noble band that farmed the Phoenix Valley down in Arizona land. Well, down the ditches for 10,000 years, the sparkling waters rushed. And a white man stole the water rights, and all the running water's hushed. Now ours folks go hungry, their farms grow crops of weeds. But when war came, our volunteered and forgot the white man's greed.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Candy Mossett. She's the lead organizer for Extreme Energy and Just Transition Campaign for the Indigenous Environmental Network. So Orrin Hatch actually made some statements while he was appearing with Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke about the Trump administration's order to shrink or eliminate these 30, nearly 30 national monuments. He said that Native Americans were manipulated into their support for the 1.35 million acre Bears Ears National Monument. Let me just read the quote. "The Indians, they don't fully understand that a lot of the things that they currently take for granted on those lands, they won't be able to do if it's made clearly into a monument or a wilderness. Once you put a monument there, you do restrict a lot of things that could be done, and that includes use of the land. Just take my word for it." What is he talking about there?
I wonder if he even knows. I mean, it sounds like he's saying we don't want to have Bears Ears as a national monument because we want to control it. And Native people shouldn't have it either because then they won't be able to control it because we're going to like put a fence around it and you can't go in there or something. I mean, obviously he's just, to me, representing for the other side being the Trump administration. When I'm hearing it, I remember hearing that now, but when you read it again, it just made me, it made me angry.
It's very condescending.
It's very condescending. It's just a way to say, oh, well, we know how to take care of you better than you know how to take care of yourselves, which has sort of been the policy of the United States, you know, since they first came over and stole the land from the people that were here.
It seems like now that there's a lot of white resentment towards Native Americans for the expansion of gambling and casinos within various tribes. Can you explain how that's affected not only internally the Native American experience over the last few decades, but also feeling towards Native Americans?
Here's the thing. This resentment has always existed because people don't want to admit what this country is founded upon, which is the raping, pillaging, and stealing of Native American lands. I mean, I grew up on a reservation and learned in elementary school that Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492 and discovered America. And when I raised my hand, I think I was in third grade, "Hey, teacher, that's great. Where were we? Because we were here already." And the answer I got was, "We're not covering that. That's not in the book." And so the thing is that all of the things that are coming to a head now, when we talk about the Trump administration, when we talk about the fight at Standing Rock, are pointing out the history of this country. And it's something that we're going to have to deal with collectively as a nation if we ever want to move forward in a way that is true to what we believe or what we're supposed to believe within our Constitution and within our, you know, great nation. If we really want to be what this country claims it is, we have to look at the history and what we're founded upon. And so Trump being the president is just triggering even more of these feelings and emotions because he personally is completely racist when it comes to Native American people because of the bottom line, because many of us on reservations had a fought as a way to have some kind of economic independence in our communities. And that turned out to be reservations. Now, I was still pretty young in 1990 when a lot of these, you know, I remember when our casino was built. I didn't know any of the politics behind it. I just knew that, you know, my sister had a job. She was able to work there. I believe she was a waitress at the restaurant, you know, that came. It brought economic development to our really poor community, and it brought a place for people to work. And so as I got older, I understood that it was this bone of contention You know, but I thought, well, why aren't people mad at Las Vegas then? You know, why don't people attack that place more? You know, I started questioning all these things. And I realized that there was just a large, large level of racism that exists and an unfounded hatred that exists for the Native people in this country. And my question was always, why? What did we ever do? And we were here, basically. We were in the way of capitalistic ideals and capitalistic development, which still exist today, which are getting us into this whole problem we see on a worldwide level now when we talk about climate change and we talk about the pollution of drinking water, the pollution of air. But that's another piece that this administration isn't willing to admit. I mean, Donald Trump is a known climate denier. I mean, he flat out just makes these statements about how it's just not true. And the thing is like, you don't even need to have a scientific background to understand that climate change is very real. You just need to have common sense. Then again, we are talking about Donald Trump. I can go out and I can see the berries aren't blooming when they used to. It's about a month or two off. I can go fishing and I can see that it's shifting the fish that we're pulling out of the lake. We're seeing fish with cancers that we've never seen before, pulling out fish with deformities. The same is happening with the moose in Canada, for example. I have a lot of Canadian friends that still live off the land, very much subsistence lifestyles. And it can't be understood by a person that just goes to the grocery store. If you don't understand subsistence lifestyles, and that's what we try to do at the Indigenous Environmental Network too, is to bridge cultures together. Because the whole thing that we're facing is a lack of communication, a lack of understanding, or a lack of willingness to try to communicate. And with Donald Trump, it's just all getting called out. Things that have always been bubbling under the surface are getting called out and brought to the limelight, into the attention. And Bears Ears National Monument is just one more example of a group of, I would say, good old boys that don't want things to change. It's in human nature to fear change. But this group of people, they want to be in power. And for them, power is money. And that means controlling as much of the major economic things as possible. This Bears Ears National Monument, they probably want to destroy it. One, because they're racist. But two, because they want to build something there. They want to frack. You know, they want to drill. And with that comes more money.
Well, it's important work that you and your colleagues are doing at the Indigenous Environmental Network. People can check out your website at ienearth.org. Candy Mossett, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the Digga Rhythm Band, Tuckin' Patty, and Towns Van Zandt.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.